Hello everyone, and welcome to episode 5 of season 11 of Movie on Minute, the daily podcast, where we curry our way through the award-winning miniseries from 2001, Band of Brothers, 5 minutes at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today to finish off his stint and allow him to not have to watch any more of this miniseries if he doesn't want to, is Todd Liebenow of the Forgotten Filmcast. Welcome back for yet another episode, Todd.
Thank you. It makes me sound so awful, like I won't watch it.
Well, let's
I'll get to it.
If you haven't seen it in the 20, now it's been 25 years because, you know, we've passed into 2026. So you can, you know, or let's say it's been a little over 20. 25 years this movie came out and you haven't seen it yet. So, you know, one of those, I had a friend in high school that he had a sign on his locker that was a round to it, T-U-I-T. Right. And the joke always was, is, you know, I don't need to get around to it because I have around to it.
Yes.
So, you know, it's one of those things. If it's something that's important enough to you, you make the time for it, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you finish recording today, go upstairs, tell Amy, we're now going to sit and watch the next 9 parts of Band of Brothers, and she'll be like, oh, finally, after 25 years of being married to me, you're interested in watching this movie with me.
She'll be like, I saw it already. I don't, you know, that's the thing. I still don't know when she would have watched it, but all right.
I don't know. I think you need to start getting a little, you know, maybe you need to hire a private investigator to find out what's going on. I'm sure everything's okay. All right. So, episode 5 begins with Sink getting an idea and ends with the men getting some instructions about being paratroopers. So, we ended things yesterday with Sobel getting his gold pin, making him officially a captain from Sink. And Sink then changes the subject and starts talking about Winters. And then he says to Sobel, I was planning on giving him a set of these today. Why don't you do it? He'd be proud to get them from you. So what this tells us basically is Sink is not completely in tune with everything that's going on. You know, the fact that he thinks, you look at it from the perspective that maybe Winters is good at pretending that, that he likes his commander. I don't know.
Well, I mean, it is a theme that we see from time to time in military movies, or even ones that are centered around police, where the head person is oblivious to the person that's, you know, a bit too hard on the men or what have you. All right, I'm going to draw a weird parallel here, okay? The way that Sink is kind of oblivious to what Sobel does reminds me of how Commandant Lassard is oblivious to what Harris does in the first Police Academy movie, okay?
Okay.
Which I make no apologies. I love those stupid movies, okay? But, you know, like... Commandant Lassard is, you know, clueless. He's got his little fish, and that's his little world. And, you know, has no idea that that Harris is such a jerk to all the men. He just thinks, you know, he's just fine. And so it's kind of the same kind of dynamic here. Sinks a little bit in his own little world. He's got his office there, you know, and everything's just all rosy for him. He doesn't know what is really going on out there.
Okay, that is a great analogy that I definitely would not have expected to come from Todd Liebenow. I mean, I know you liked movies from 1984. There's no question about that. I didn't, for some reason, I as well as I know you, I would not have thought that Police Academy would have jumped into your mind with some of the things that goes on in that movie. But hey, that's fine. You know, I'm also like you. I'm a child of the 80s. I'm a student of movies of the 80s, so For sure. I don't have a problem with that.
Can I veer off into a weird direction here though? There's something that just hit me as I was, watching this moment again and, just scribbling down a few notes. Okay. And I know we saw a little bit of this last time, but it just kind of gelled with me here getting ready for this recording. It always bugs me when we have military brass, I don't know what you want to call them, the higher ups, okay, or when they dress up, in their fancier uniforms, okay, and they tuck in the ties. And you have that in this scene here. Sink and Sobel and them, they're wearing ties, and then the tie is tucked in to, go underneath like the second button or whatever, okay. Which I've always found that to be the stupidest thing because I'm like, what's the point of wearing the tie? Especially when, like, if you look into the history of ties, of neckties, why did that become a thing in the first place? The thing that I always heard was that it was to hide the buttons. For some reason, the buttons were offensive. You wore a tie to cover up the buttons. So if you tuck in the tie, that completely defeats the purpose, if there truly is any, of wearing a necktie. So I have never understood.
Well, you won't see
Okay,
the
I
buttons
take
in
that
either.
back. I understand that they probably tuck it in because the tie gets in the way. Okay, it could get caught in something, whatever. Okay, but if that's the case, don't wear the tie in the first place. Tucking it in is dumb.
Well, thankfully, Todd Leibonow is not in charge of military code
Oh, I
of
should
how you're
be
supposed to put your
a
tie
grumpy
on.
old man, and I'm gonna tell you what I think about necktie.
Apparently, that is what you're doing, and that's fine. That works. That works.
Well, I'll have another grumpy old man moment for you here in a moment, okay? Because
I'm looking forward to it.
I found an error in this movie, I think, or this
Ooh.
miniseries.
All right. I'm looking
You
forward to it.
may have it already, but yeah, I had to look into this, so.
We expect at this point that Sobel is going to be going to go give Winters his his rank insignia, but he doesn't. Instead, we see Sobel in the middle of the barracks, basically berating and chiding the men with everything that's going on. And at this point we're trying to figure out really what's going on because it isn't explained completely, except for the fact that we hear Sobel just yelling and screaming and saying, he throws a whole bunch of stuff onto one of the beds, and then he says, pornography, contraband, non-regulation
Okay.
clothing, contraband.
Here's where I think I found something. All right.
Okay.
So he picks up the magazine and says pornography. Okay. And if you look at the magazine, it says it's Titter magazine,
Okay.
Titter. Okay. And I was like, okay, I'm curious. Is this an actual magazine? All right. And so I looked it up, and yes, it's an actual magazine. Now, these scenes that we're talking about, when do they take place?
They take place in 1943, 1942.
Okay. So I
Sorry,
just,
1940, is it 1942 or 40? I believe it's still 19, it's either late 42 or
or
early 43.
43. Yes. That's what I deduced as well. Okay. So, when I was looking up to see if Titter magazine was a real thing, and I saw it come up, and I actually saw websites where people have copies of these old magazines and they're selling them to collectors and things like that. And
Wait a second,
this
you bought one?
very, no, I didn't buy one. Okay. This was
Know
just
you didn't.
12 hours ago when I was looking this stuff up. Okay. So, anyway, I'm looking and I see a site that's selling these. And this actual cover is there. I saw it. I was like, there's the one that they used. June 1944 is when this issue is from. So One of the guys in Easy Company is apparently a time traveler who went forward and bought this magazine and brought it back. And now it's contraband.
That is so cool. Nicely done, Todd. I love how it says on it, gals and gags.
Yes.
Wow, someone is selling it for $300.
Oh, wow.
It's in excellent condition. Summer issue, 25 cents.
Wow. I wonder if the gags thing, I mean, it almost sounds like it's, you know, like part Cheesecake Magazine, part Mad Magazine. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. The person selling it in Madison, Connecticut, if you're interested. Wow, that is such a great catch. That really is. Nicely done.
Thank you. Thank you.
Very, very impressed. Again, I'm still trying to figure out what the gags is. You know, the gals aspect I can understand.
Yeah, yeah. Well, maybe that's it. Maybe this particular private was not interested in the gals. He was interested in the gags. It's just like saying, I buy it for the articles.
That's true. Maybe he does.
Yeah.
That is so interesting. $300 for this particular thing. Wow. I'm still in shock that. Again, the fact that this is considered pornography back then is also a separate issue. Yes. But okay.
Yes.
You know.
I mean, I'm sure it's tamer than the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue. So yeah.
Quite possible. I found another site that mentions that it's connected to Captain Herbert Zobel. So interesting. Right. So, okay. Yes. So he has this this contraband that he's showing to everybody, and then he spills a whole bunch of other stuff onto a bed, and he pulls out a necktie, and he then says, "Non-regulation clothing, contraband."
Which, if they're going to tuck it into their buttons, what difference does it make? The next one, though, is the one that got me the most, okay? Because they have somebody has 200 prophylactic kits, okay?
That's right. Which, he of course, with a box, and he goes, "This man had 200 prophylactic kits in his footlocker. How in the name of God was he going to have the strength to fight the war?"
And of course, that means condoms for folks that aren't aware, and I was like, well, I guess some things are always true, because I know from having worked in a drugstore in my youth that regularly one of the most shoplifted items, because you got to assume whoever had the 200 packs stole some from somewhere else. But yeah, condoms are regularly one of the most shoplifted items in stores, which is part of why, nowadays a lot of places they're in cases, or in those little lock boxes that they need to get at. But like when I was a stock boy working in the drugstore, we would be like straightening up the items at the end of the day, and you would sometimes find empty boxes of condoms stuck behind other items because someone had snatched them off that part of the shelf, opened it up, shoved the condoms in their pocket, and ditched the box. It's just
interesting.
Okay. Like I say, people steal them a lot.
Now, did you notice the actor standing next to
yes. David Schwimmer? This one I got. I did not catch Michael Fassbender, but in this moment, as soon as the camera pulled out, I was like, oh, it's just Simon Pegg.
That's right. Simon Pegg plays Sergeant Evans, who we will see quite often in this part.
And now... he's not British, right? He's not supposed to be British here.
No,
am I correct?
Well, Michael Fassbender is also British. I mean,
they have a lot
of British actors who are playing American soldiers. Instead of taking them, instead of flying them to England, so they had the local actors.
Yeah.
And again,
that... I mean, like, the first thing that went through my mind, my brain went to, like, It went to Dr. Strangelove and Peter Sellers, how you have when he plays Mandrake, you know, he's playing a British officer, but in an American, army base, because allies cooperating with each other. So my first thought was, oh, well, you know, Simon Pegg's so British. She must be playing some kind of a, a British soldier that's on loan, or I don't know what. But as things progressed, I was like, oh no, he's supposed to be American. Okay.
No. And then Evans hands Sobel a list of a whole bunch of letters, and then Sobel goes, "How is it, Private Tipper has spare time for so much correspondence?" And then Winter says to him, "Captain, are personal letters to be considered contraband?" And he goes, "These men aren't paratroopers yet, Lieutenant. They have no personal property." Then he pulls out a tin can and goes, "What is this? Anybody?" And Nixon goes, "Oh, it's a can of peaches, sir." "Lieutenant Nixon thinks this is a can of peaches." "That is incorrect, Lieutenant. Your weekend pass is canceled. This is United States Army property, which was taken without authorization from my mess facility, and I will not tolerate thievery in my unit." "Whose footlocker is this?" "Private Park, sir. Get rid of him." He goes, "All weekend passes are canceled, officers included." And he goes, "Carry on." So again, he's looking for reasons to enact
I
punishments.
mean,
That's what it comes down to.
jumping back to the line you're saying about how they don't have any personal property, then my first thought that went through my mind was, then why do they have footlockers? If there's no personal property, if it's all community property at this point, there would be no reason to give them footlockers, would there?
That is a great question. Wow, I didn't even think about that one. I don't have an answer to that. I see. I don't like the fact that he refers to the mess hall as my mess hall. You know, it's like it's not as if they're on a base where he is the top ranking officer. If that was the case, then I can understand him say that. But he is not. And then the way that this at this point I want to actually read something from the book, which refers to things that Sobel and Evans would do, because Evans was apparently Sobel's lackey. Okay, he was the company sergeant, and he was doing stuff. So here it says, "Your rifle is your right arm," Sobel would tell his men. "It should be your possession every moment." On one night exercise, he decided to teach his men a lesson. He and Sergeant Evans went sneaking through the company position to steal rifles from sleeping men. The mission was successful. By daylight, Sobel and Evans had nearly 50 rifles. With great fanfare, Evans called the company together, and Sobel began to tell the men what miserable soldiers they were. As he was yelling, the CO of Fox Company, accompanied by some 45 of his men, came up. To Sobel's great embarrassment, it turned out that he and Evans had been lost, straight into Fox Company's HUVAC area, and stolen their rifles. Couple of weeks later, Sobel hurt his feet on a jump. He and Sergeant Evans returned to barracks while the company stayed in the field. The captain and the first sergeant conducted a private inspection. They searched through all the footlockers, clothing, and personal possessions of the men of E Company. They went through pockets, broke open boxes, rifled letters from girlfriends and family, and confiscated all items they considered contraband. I don't know what the hell they were looking for," Gordon Carson commented. Those were the days before drugs. Sobel posted a list identifying the contraband, the offender, and the punishment. The men returned from the field exercise, exhausted and filthy, to find that everything they thought of as personal property was in disarray. Underwear, socks, toothpaste, and toothbrushes all piled up on the bunks. Many items were missing. Nearly every soldier had something confiscated. Generally, it was unauthorized ammunition, non-regulation clothing, or pornography. Cans of fruit cocktail and sliced peaches stolen from the kitchen were gone, along with expensive shirts. None of it ever returned. One soldier had been collecting prophylactic kits. A few condoms were evidently acceptable, but 200 constituted contraband. They were posted on Sobel's list of confiscated items. And it's funny that he talks about here from the letters, Private Tipper. So it says, that marked a turning point for me, Tipper recalled. Before Sobel's raid, I had disliked him, but had not really hated the man. Afterwards, I decided Sobel was my personal enemy, and I did not owe him loyalty or anything else. Everyone was incensed.
You know, the bit about them getting lost and raiding the rifles from the wrong barracks. I mean, I get you can't put everything in a movie, but it would have foreshadowed things that come later. So.
Yeah. Yes, that's true. But again, I'm always impressed with the way that someone took this nonfiction book that's not being told in story form and created this type of story. I mean, here, you know, we had all of these little things that they mentioned that he took because it was contraband. But here he's actually showing the officers all of these things, including, you know, the letters, including the tie, including the peaches, including the condoms, all these different things. So it's just, it's
I
nice
love that kind of stuff too. I mean, I admit I'm not a huge reader. I enjoy reading, but I always say I'm a very slow reader. So it makes it hard for me to, really spend a long time with a book. But I much more, when I do read, tend to go towards nonfiction books. And I love when you have a movie or a miniseries like this, and they work in those little details that you saw as you read these nonfiction accounts of things. Like one that comes to my mind for that, and I admit the movie is hit and miss. I enjoy it because I enjoy the book a lot, but is Clint Eastwood's movie based on Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. The book is just so rich, and there's so many little details in it. And I've enjoyed reading that book, and I love looking at the movie and then just picking up on little things here and there. You go, oh, they mentioned that in the book. Oh, they mentioned that, and it's not something that's drawn out as a centerpiece, but there's those little things peppered throughout that, just you understand more when you've read the book and you know that those were minor little details that were in there. So, yeah, I love it when you have movies based on nonfiction books and they do that kind of thing.
Correct. Yeah, I always like that.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it doesn't have to be nonfiction. You can do that with fiction also. And at this point, Sobel asks for Winters to follow him. And, Winters comes outside with him. And I like the little touch that as they both get outside, they both take out their hats and have to put their hats on. You know, like regulation.
There's so almost the slightest hint that, like, I wasn't sure that that was like regulation, like that's the way they do it. I almost got the slightest hint that Winters hesitates just a bit and sees, oh, Sobel's doing it, so I better do it.
Right. Very possible. And then Sobel turns around and says to him, Colonel Sink has seen fit to promote you. As first lieutenant, you'll serve as my executive officer. Congratulations. Thank you, sir. And as a test of your organizational skills and command potential, I'm just designating you mess officer for 14 days. Report to the mess kitchen at 0515 hours. Company breakfast to be served at 0600? Yes, sir. Oh, and Dick, there's rain forecast tomorrow, so the company will have a light afternoon of lecture and classroom instruction. I think a special meal before their afternoon off would be a welcome change of pace. Would you agree? Yes, sir.
Now,
I like spaghetti.
I feel like being assigned to the mess hall is a demotion. I don't know, but yes, that doesn't feel like you're being rewarded there.
You know, KP, I mean, I read Beetle Bailey all my youth.
Yeah, me too.
So if you're talking about, KP, that's a punishment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah, it's funny that he says, I want to test your organizational skills. You know, what type of BS is that? Let's see how you organize the kitchen for breakfast.
Right, right.
You sort of get the impression of how devious his character actually must be to be able to do something like this.
Yeah, yeah. this is the moment that kind of takes the cake. And I mean, if you weren't hating Sobel by this point, this nails it.
Yeah. At this point, we see the men in the mess hall, getting their special lunch. Which you know, goes back to what we saw yesterday with your biscuits and gravy.
Yeah, no, I mean spaghetti wouldn't be my first point, but
I'm saying the way that they just slap it onto the onto their plates, which are like actually bowls.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting the way that they do. You know what I find fascinating is that it sounds when Sobel is giving this information to Winters, it actually sounds that he's, you know, he has good intentions here. You know, we don't know yet that he doesn't, but just the way that he says it, he says, "Oh, tomorrow's gonna be a light day, so you know, I like spaghetti. Let's make sure everyone has spaghetti."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I don't know that I was. I mean, I guess you want to give the guy the benefit of the doubt, but I wasn't buying it quite at the point. My suspicions ended up being true. You know, so I think it was the bit about the lectures that made me, I was like, really? I don't think this guy puts a lot of stock in lectures based on what I've seen so far. So I'm surprised that that's what we're going to do.
No, they it's common knowledge that you know, when you're in the military, you're sitting in a lot of classroom situations where you're learning about things, learning mm-hmm. about tactics, learning about weapons, you know, things like that. So those are stuff that you normally would wait and do on a day when the weather isn't that good to be doing stuff outside.
Mm, okay. You know,
and then so we see the guys getting this slop put on their plates, and then the guy in the on KP, I guess, mm-hmm. says, "Hold on, more coming." And he takes the pot, you know, back to, in order to bring in a new pot. And, you know, he turns to one of the other guys and goes, "These guys are just packing it away." Gives us the impression of how much they're all going to be eating. And we see Winters, you know, pacing in the background, watching this all go through.
Mm-hmm.
And then we see the men just packing in the food. And then Dietrich says, "This stuff is orange. Spaghetti ain't supposed to be orange."
I don't know. Didn't look that orange to me, but you know. So.
Yeah, I know. Well, it's because the colors are saturated in this, you know, the way that they film this. And he goes, "This ain't spaghetti. This is army noodles with ketchup."
Yeah, which just sounds gross. I mean, I'm not the biggest fan of noodle-based things to start with. I mean, spaghetti, for example. When they said that, I was like, you know, I can deal with spaghetti, but it wouldn't be my top choice as a special meal. It's definitely not my death row meal. Let's put it that way. But yeah, doing it though is just
no. That'll be biscuits and
biscuits and gravy. Sure. Yeah. No, I can deal with that. Yeah, but. Yeah, just noodles with ketchup. That's pretty great.
So, where does the word ketchup come from?
Now, ketchup or catsup?
Well, that's the thing. It was written as ketchup, K-E-T-C-H-U-P, C-A-T-K-C-H-U-P, and K-A-T-S-U-P. Those are the three derivations of it.
Mm. Yeah, I have no idea the origins of it at all, but
okay. So it goes back to the 17th century, the late 1600s. 1682 is the first time that the word ketchup appeared in print, in a book known as The Natural History of Coffee, Tea, Chocolate, Tobacco. Hmm. And the quote is, "I do not doubt, but you London gentlemen do value chocolate above all your cullises and jellies, your anchovies, bononia sausages, your cockerel lambstones, your soys, your ketchup and caviars, your cantharides, and your whites of eggs are not to be compared to our rude Indian." So, whatever. Mm. He Even Dickens used ketchup in his works. In his book Barnaby Rudge, it says some lamb chops breaded with plenty of ketchup. In the 1600s, mushrooms were used as a primary ingredient rather than tomatoes.
Oh wow!
Which to me sounds so gross. But the colonists during the 13 colonies would have lots of mushroom ketchup all the way back in the 1700s.
Maybe that's one of those other varieties, because you know the Heinz bottle always says 57 varieties. Maybe the mushroom ketchup.
Well, they now have more than that, don't they?
I don't know. I just always remember that the Heinz 57 thing will help you remember a certain bit of baseball trivia, because you know it was how many consecutive games did Joe DiMaggio have a hit in whatever year it was? And it's 56, because there's always the bit of trivia that he had a, you know, some kind of a endorsement deal or something that was going to come around with the Heinz company if he had made it to 57, and he came short by one. So
interesting. Okay, so the first known recipe of tomato ketchup was in 1812, which included anchovies and insects.
Of course, why wouldn't you?
Not necessarily something that I would have thought of.
Of course, our modern ketchup probably still has insects in it, just not intentionally. Who knows what happens in the ketchup factory?
That's true. What happens in the ketchup factory stays in the ketchup factory.
Exactly. It's just like Vegas.
Yeah, exactly. By the 1850s, they took out anchovies from the ingredients. And not long afterwards, in 1876, F&J Heinz launched their own tomato ketchup. And within 20 years, there were hundreds of brands of ketchup on the market. And a few of them were considered good. The advertisement the slogan for Heinz ketchup at the beginning was "Blessed relief for mother and the other women in the household," a slogan which alluded to the lengthy process required to produce tomato ketchup in the home. So the idea was you can just go buy it instead of having them to actually sit and make it.
Sure, yeah.
There's even research that's been done on ketchup bottles. 2017, researchers at MIT reported the development of a bottle coating that allowed all the product to slip out without leaving a residue, which again, you know, part of the problem is getting that little bit out of the bottom of the the bottle. And in 2022, researchers in Oxford found that splatter from a near empty bottle can be prevented by squeezing more slowly and doubling the diameter of the nozzle.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
I always remember, you know, before we had such thing as squeeze bottles for ketchup, and you just had the glass bottle. Someone showed me once that you don't want to tap the back of the bottle. That actually doesn't help it come out. But if you tapped like the top of the bottle nearby where the nozzle was, that it helped help it flow better. So
okay. That's
what I used to do. But now it's all plastic, and you just squeeze. So
that's right. And you can get multicolored ketchup also, which I think is, I still just need red ketchup. I won't eat that purple ketchup or green ketchup. You know, Sam I am.
Right, yeah.
And then Garnier says, well, if you ain't going to eat it, and he grabs the plate, and then Percanti says, oh, come on, gonorrhea. As a fellow Italian, you should know that calling this crap spaghetti is a mortal sin. If you want it or not, he goes, no, I'm eating here. Get out of here. And then their conversation is broken up when Sobel shows up in the room and blows a whistle and goes, orders changed, get up, lectures are canceled, Easy Company is running up Currahee, move, 3 miles up, 3 miles down.
Okay, there's
Otto
actually
Silver.
Can I jump in here, because there was something odd I spotted in the background just before Sobel comes in. Okay, and this I kind of alluded to this last time, but did you notice the Coke machine in the background?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Which, I mean, didn't bother me that much, but I was kind of like, do we really, I mean, you know, am I to believe that in the mess hall, the military here, that they offer up Cokes to the men? I'm thinking probably you know, certainly back at this time, Coke was not necessarily on the menu. This seemed to me like, Yeah, let's get a little product placement in here and see if we can get a little Coke money for the production. I don't know, but it didn't strike me that that the mess hall would actually be serving up Coca-Cola in 1943. I could be wrong though.
Okay, I don't know. I didn't do any research on that, so I couldn't tell you either way. But what I love here though is as Sobel is giving these commands, he's looking directly at Winters, and Winters looks at him and knows that Sobel did this on purpose. So we see that Winters is trying to figure out how he's supposed to deal with this. And he just goes back watching all the men think. And then we the shot changes and the men are running up the mountain while throwing up some of them.
Which, you know, I
One of the
mean,
guys is completely puking. He goes, "You're a washout, Private Hubler. You should pack up both your ears and go home." And he screams, "Looks like Gordon's done, aren't you, Gordon? You've finished." He's like taunting the guys as they're running. It's
yeah.
crazy.
Well, and I'm sure I'm not the only person to ever watch this and have, been secretly wanting the one of them to just turn right around and stare Sobel in the face and puke right on him. I mean, not outside the realm of possibility here for this scene.
That's very true. And then he screams at him, "You do not deserve to get your wings, Private Randleman. You look tired. There's an ambulance waiting for you at the bottom of the hill. It can all be over right now. No more pain, no more Kurahi, no more Captain Sobel." And then the men actually start singing, and they go, "We pull upon the risers, we fall upon the grass. We never land upon our feet, we always hit our ass. Aye, aye, Christ Almighty, who the hell are we? Zim, zam, goddamn, we're airborne infantry. We pull upon the risers, we fall upon the grass. We never land upon our feet. We always hit our ass. Hi, tidy, Christ Almighty, who the hell are we? Zim zam, goddamn, we're airborne infantry." One of the things that is great as they're running, we see that as much as Sobel is taunting these guys, and you see a lot of them are sweating, and the question is whether they're sweating because of the run or they're sweating because they've been puking. I mean, some of them, you see a lot of them have like
Yeah, they have stains on their on the front.
stains on the front of their shirts from this whole thing. And then Sobel stands on the side watching them all run by, and he sees that Winters runs with them, which again is great. Once again showing the type of commander that Winters is.
Winters runs with them, yeah.
Sobel is not happy about the fact that he sees that Winters is with them, because he knows that the men respect Winters more than they respect him. And he wants that respect for himself. So it's nicely done, the way that they have them run through this whole thing. And then we just get a few seconds of Sobel watching them run away and then get ready to run with them. And then the shot changes and we see an airplane flying. And then we see a bunch of the men in the airplane getting ready. They're all wearing helmets. I guess this is
Football
the first time
helmets,
you're
it looks like.
football helmets. Okay. And Sobel looks scared out of his wits. He's not happy here at all. And then the shot changes, and we see the men getting instructions from I guess from a paratrooper instructor, which makes a lot of sense. So I wanted to read the what it talks about in the book about this spaghetti incident, because again, it's
That's
real.
it's a good title for a movie, The Spaghetti Incident.
"At the end of the second week," Tipper went on, "we were told, 'Relax, no runs today.' We were taken to the mess hall for a tremendous meal of spaghetti at lunchtime. When we came out of the mess hall, a whistle blew, and we were told, 'The orders are changed. We run.' We went to the top of Kurahi and back with a couple of ambulances following, the men vomiting spaghetti everywhere along the way. Those who dropped out and accepted the medic's invitation to ride back in the ambulances found themselves shipped out the same day." Again, it was used, here we have him taunting Randleman and basically saying, "Look, the ambulance is waiting for you down there. But if you ended up taking the easy way out, I guess, by going down with the ambulances, then they would basically kick you out of the airborne." It was a way. It was another way, I guess, for them to try and weed men out. Weed out the weak. Todd, do you have anything else you want to say about these particular 5 minutes or anything about the entire movie.
I mean, I think we covered it. I can't talk about much more of the entire movie because I have seen the end of this episode, but I have not seen further than that. So, but
all right. Well, you have your homework.
Yes. Yes, I do.
All right. Excellent. So today's segment will be a segment called Oh Brother, where my guests will give their list of top five brothers in movies.
Okay. So movies with brothers. And this is favorites. This is not necessarily best. Okay. So five, I went with Twins. Four, From Dusk Till Dawn. Three, let's just call it The Godfather, because I know Rob won't let me get away with putting both as one. But
very good.
Let's say The Godfather. Two, Tombstone, the Earp Brothers. And then one, I think Rob could probably guess, because of my youth in the Chicago area, I'm going to say the Blues Brothers.
What a surprise.
Yeah.
I knew that the Blues Brothers were going to be high up there.
Yes.
So, yeah, makes sense. There's nothing wrong with that. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone likes the Blues Brothers. Why not?
Yes, absolutely.
Exactly. All right. And now, thank you for that list. We will now once again play for the final time for Todd the game of Name That World War II Movie. So let's spin the wheel and see what we get. Okay, this is an interesting one. I'm wondering if this is something you're going to be able to figure out.
Mm.
Hopefully you will be able to. This is a movie from 1965, and it's about prisoners in a North African military prison who must deal with the sadistic guards.
1965, North African prison, sadistic guards.
It was directed by Sidney Lumet, and it stars Sean Connery.
Oh, boy. I don't have it. I don't know.
Okay. It is a movie called The Hill.
I've seen the image of the poster, but yeah, I haven't seen that one yet.
Okay. Fair enough. Fair enough. All right. So, Todd, would you like to once again tell people where they can find Todd Liebenau?
So the podcast is called The Forgotten Filmcast. You can find that wherever you find your podcasts. The blog is at forgottenfilmcast.wordpress.com. And if you search for at Forgotten Films, films spelled with a Z, you should find us on the various social media outlets. And then also search for my name, Todd Liebenau, on Letterboxd. You will find me over there. I always follow folks back on Letterboxd.
All right. Excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to movierobminute@movierob.net. You can find me on Facebook, find me on Twitter, and you can find me on Instagram. So, Todd, thank you very much for joining me and for taking the plunge to actually start watching this. I do appreciate that.
Thank you for having me. Taking the plunge, is that, you know, in reference to jumping out of airplanes, you know, that type of thing? That's a very, very good way of describing it there, Rob. Very appropriate.
Okay. I wasn't even referring to that, but that works.
Taking the plummet, it would probably be in my case, you know, because I'd be the guy whose chute didn't open probably.
All right. Fair enough. Let's hope not.
Yes.
How's that?
Well, I have no plans of jumping out of an airplane anytime soon, so, you know.
And, well, just make sure you have an emergency chute.
Yeah.
You hopefully will. I will be back on Monday with a new guest. But until then, Curry!